Our very distinguished guest for yesterday and today is Professor Eric Routley of the Westminster Choir College, theologian, musician, author, composer, lecturer, all par excellence, and he has honored us by coming to be our spring lecturer this year. We also are very pleased to have had with us for these 2 days Mrs. Routley. And this is not their first visit to North Carolina, but certainly we are glad to have had them make this first visit to our campus and hope it will be the first of many yet to come. Professor Routley is always interested to talk to students and other people and is going to meet the hymnody class at 1 o'clock this afternoon. In which room does that meet, Mrs. Humble? In the music room downstairs this building. So even if you're not one of the members of that class and want to get in on the conversation, you're invited to meet in that with that group at 1 o'clock. And also at 11 o'clock, Professor Routley will join the faculty for the faculty coffee break and give us a chance to talk to him a little bit there. We are very delighted to have him with us today, and we now hear his second lecture. Professor Routley, we are so glad to have you.
They said to, oh good heavens, I'll start again. I seem to be much more powerful today than I was yesterday. They said to Moses, "Why don't you take us back to prison? When things were difficult in the time of the Exodus." The psalmist said, "Bring my soul out of prison that it may praise thee." I want to know which of those is what you yourselves want, to go back to prison or to be let out. I am reminded of something I heard, I suppose 25 years ago, from one of my favorite preachers in England. He was telling us how he had, in the course of a few days, met two people. Now, this is the date of this actual meeting. Let us say it was about 1946 or 1947, just after the end of World War II. Come to think of it, I suppose it must have been about perhaps 1948, because of what I'm about to say. He didn't tell us the date, but put it about then, before any of you were born, but 1948 we'll call it. Well, he first met in a train a middle-aged couple who had been missionaries in China. And yes, it must have been 1948, because they, after being silenced and arrested and put in custody, had managed to get away. And he got talking to them, and they of course were talking about the situation that had developed in China in 1948, which was of course the beginning of the regime now so mournfully familiar to us. And he heard them saying, if only there was a chance of getting back there, we would go. They were still hoping that it wouldn't be long before Christian activity of their kind could be resumed. And they said, when it happens, we will go at once. That was their reaction to having been imprisoned. And then he proceeded to tell us of a young man whom he knew who had been a prisoner of war and had spent a long time in the miserable custody of a German prisoner of war camp. Young man in his 20s, who then had been set free and sent home and had to take up the living of a normal life. But this young man was having the most appalling problems. He couldn't hold a job down. He couldn't turn up on time for an appointment. He couldn't get up in the morning and get himself shaved. He was utterly helpless. And this was one of my friend's pastoral problems, to try and get this young man on his feet. And here was the opposite condition, you see, of somebody who had got freedom that he didn't know how to use. Freedom that was too much for him. And he was saying, take me back to my prison camp. He never actually said it, but that's what his psychology was. He couldn't cope with being a free man. Now, there are people, as you know, who can be free men and women in the most daunting situations. And there can be people who've got all the freedom in the world and are prisoners. Prison does not have to be a prisoner of war camp or the local lockup. It can be a Hilton. I'm sure that one could make arrangements in a Hilton hotel to have the door of one's room locked and the key thrown away. You can live in your luxurious prison as long as you like, but it's a prison. Now, if I want to talk about hymnody, you may think that I've come to the wrong place and started the wrong speech. No, not a bit. If I want to talk about hymnody, I cannot see the folk song of the Christian people, which is what hymnody is, as being anything but a menace and a pollution unless it nourishes the growth of the Christian mind and affections. For the reasons that I was mentioning yesterday, namely that, especially if people are not particularly musical, music can do anything it likes to them, I am bound to judge that some kinds of song, Christian or otherwise, can help the Christian mind and heart to degenerate, to get to such a condition that they're incapable of using that glorious freedom which is given to the sons of God. And another kind, I am clear, helps one to grow, helps one to become a more responsible, more compassionate, more flexible, and yet more committed believer in the risen Christ. I am most anxious to commend to you habits of hymn singing which nourish, not habits of hymn singing which cause degeneracy. There was an occasion that I often mention, I'm rather fond of remembering, in my church in Newcastle, the place in England I lived in before I came here, when during the coffee hour after the morning service, We started that coffee hour while I was there, but of course it was something that I learnt in the United States and took home with me and said it was a good idea. And we used to give people a cup of coffee and the children a glass of fruit juice, if they wanted that, after morning service. And morning service would last an hour, and the coffee hour might last an hour and a half. You couldn't get them off the premises. They were so interested in talking to each other. I always used to love this. Well, during this, one day, a very nice little girl of about 9 came up to me, and she'd obviously been sort of primed by her mother. Her mother said, "Go on, you go and ask him. He won't bite you." And so she came to me and she said, "Please, can we have the new tune to O Jesus, I Have Promised?" And I looked at her and I said, "Now, I wonder which new tune you mean. Is it the one that goes like this? You know, one of those tunes?" And she said, "Yes, we've been singing it at school." And I said, "No, you may not." But before her face had had time to fall too far, I said, "Well, I'll tell you why." And then I said, it just happened that that morning I'd been round into the back of the place where they were serving these beverages, and looking at the fruit juice, looking at the label on the bottom, to see whether the fruit juice contained cyclamates. Now, cyclamates were something people were very frightened of in those days. I don't know whether they had 4 or 6 legs, but they were something that could get into the fruit juice and were regarded as poisonous. So I just wanted to see if we got any of those on the premises. And I said to her, "I've been round looking at that, and I found that the drinks are all right. But that stuff's poison. So is the new tune to O Jesus, I Have Promised." I then said, "Look, I got a new tune that I did want some of you youngsters to learn, and we'll have it next Sunday." "Yes, there is a certain kind of hymnody that's poison." "There's a certain kind of hymnody that is like carbohydrate. A certain amount of it will do, but too much of it will destroy your spiritual figure forever." Now, Martin Luther knew this. Let's be historical for a moment. Hymnody as we understand it, and we practically define hymnody as something that everybody can join in. That is to say, the amateur music of the church, the folk music of the church, that kind of hymnody was really invented by Martin Luther, at any rate for modern times. Now, I don't know how many Luther hymns you know, but I should think you probably know one: "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." There were 37 of them that he wrote. He wrote the words, and he probably wrote most of the tunes too. I don't know if you are aware that for his model for the tunes that he asked his people to sing, he took the most educated music that he could find. If anybody ever tells you that Luther took the popular tunes, meaning whatever corresponds to what comes out of the jukeboxes now, and made those into hymns, that is standing the truth on its head. It was the music of the troubadours that he took, and the troubadours were what corresponds to the music you hear in the concert hall. It was like somebody inventing hymnody and saying, "I will take Beethoven and Brahms for my model. I will take J.S. Bach." But of course it was a long, long time before any of those were around. And the consequence was that Luther made popular in the first generation of congregational hymn singing an extremely educated, you would say highbrow, kind of music. Now, the plain fact is that, as I say, I suspect you don't know more than 2 or 3 of these 37 Luther hymns. Many of them people actually found rather too difficult. And as the Lutheran church developed after Luther's death, a quite new kind of hymnody, which people found much more accessible, was developed. A Mighty Fortress, as you sing it, is not a bit like it was when Luther wrote it. But that appeared in 1529. In 1665, we first saw the tune Praise to the Lord the Almighty, one of the most genius-laden pieces of congregational music anybody ever produced. The longest line, the longest continuous line in all hymnody, and yet so easy to sing that everybody can sing it by heart. In 100 years, people had found the level at which people at their best could sing. Luther, I say, aimed very high, and at one or two points perhaps aimed too high. But it was possible then to come down a little way towards what people could use and produce material that has lasted 300 years and people are still loving and enjoying and even discovering. Now thank we all our God. All my heart this night rejoices. The Passion Chorale, All Glory, Lord and Honor, all those magnificent tunes came from the later generations. But those were made possible by the fact that Luther had started at such a high level. It was exactly the same with John Calvin. John Calvin in Geneva, with the Reformed culture, imposed, of course, the very austere regime by which you could sing nothing but metrical psalms, but he had the services of a musician who was a genius. And in the Genevan Psalters, as they're always called, the language was French, the Genevan Psalters of 1542 and the succeeding years, you will find a string of the most magnificent tunes. No question there of saying, we will have what the most careless and stupid person can sing easily. We will have what ordinary unmusical people, after a very small amount of effort, can sing. Well, they produced 150 psalms and 110 tunes for them. And among those tunes was All People That on Earth Do Dwell. And another of them was the old 124th, Turn Back, O Man. I'm not at all sure whether that's in your hymnal, but most people know it very well. Once again, quite a number of these great tunes of Geneva proved to be too difficult because they were too long for ordinary people to memorize. I think they probably managed fairly well in Geneva because they were French. But once the English people started trying to sing them, and there is no less musical nation than the English, once they started trying to sing them, they said, we've forgotten where we are when we've singing tunes as long as this. We want them shorter. And so the English psalters were able to produce gems in common meter. Very short, beautifully poised. Such as, I suspect you will know, the tune sung here to O God of Bethel. O God of Bethel, by whose hand thy people still are fed. That tune, first seen in 1615 and still as young as ever. And dozens of these tunes that are terribly easy for ordinary people to sing, but they were made possible by the fact that Calvin had started off at such a high level. And you could then fairly easily simplify. You could say we will use the same language but shorter words, as it were, and still produce magnificent music. That is the inspired accident, if it was an accident, that set our hymnody on its way. Now, that is a triumphant story. An impetus was given to hymnody by Luther and Calvin in the 16th century, which, if it is running on certain tracks, it still has. You could trace the development of that inspired and magnificent tune which we sang at the beginning of this hour by one of our greatest English composers, of course, in which it rather differed from the tune we sang yesterday, I noticed. You can see a direct line from there to the Calvin style. It's easy. It's beautifully poised. It has an excellent and slightly varied rhythm. It is economical. It doesn't use a word or a note more than it need. And it lasts. In fact, it's a tune that is very well known in America, but the British haven't yet started learning, and it is now 50 years old. The stream is running freely. The stream is running very strongly, but there's an awful lot of mud around its banks where it gets stuck and stagnant. Now, I think all I can say in what will seem to you a very long time, but seems to me quite a short one, all I can say is that whenever you are dealing with hymns, whether you are writing them or composing them or choosing them or just standing there singing them, somewhere in the picture there must be a vision of what is greater than we are and more beautiful than we are. Now, one of the things that will happen to you if you come out of prison, if you start wanting to exercise the glorious freedom of the children of God, is that you will find yourself in the presence of things that are larger than you are. You stay in your plushy $50 a day room in the Hilton with the door locked. You will never meet anybody larger than you. You go out in the street, you will.